much for that, guys. If you have your Bibles with you this morning, let's turn to the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Mark and the ninth chapter, the Gospel of Mark and the ninth chapter. You ever walked into a party and you realized you were the last one there, right? And it wasn't fashionably late, but I'm sorry for my delay this morning, but Gospel of Mark and chapter number 9, and we're going to look at the story that is found in verses 14 down to verse number 29, but I want to really hone in or really spend our time on one particular verse as we are talking about this issue of doubt. We're talking about how to deal with doubt in our lives. In Mark chapter 9, verse number 24, there's a response which I think really encapsulates what it is that our discussion is over the next few weeks, and that is that this father turns, it says, to Jesus, and he says, "I believe, help my unbelief." Remember last week we began this discussion of doubt and dealing with doubt in our lives, and we began by defining what doubt is. And just for clarity purposes, remember that doubt is first and foremost a temptation that comes from the enemy. And it's a temptation that is to question divine authority. Remember that when the enemy came to Adam and Eve, he said to them, "Did God really say?" It wasn't a matter of questioning whether or not God was right, but rather it was questioning whether or not God had the authority to speak at all. So doubt is first of all a temptation from the enemy, and it's a temptation that is meant to make us question divine authority. It's also a natural human condition. Doubt is something that all of us go through from time to time in our lives. It's something that all of us are well acquainted with. We talked about how doubt is presented in two forms in our life. Remember that doubt, first of all, can come in the form of academic doubt. That is a doubt that questions the sufficiency of answers that are given. In other words, we try to look at some of the difficult questions about a given matter. Answers are given. Academic doubt says, "I'm not sure that those questions or those answers reasonably deal with the questions I have." And then there is also emotional doubt. And we're going to spend our time discussing emotional doubt because it's the more prominent. It's a doubt that says, "You know what? I don't believe this, or I'm struggling with this, or I'm not willing to accept this." Not because the answers that are given are insufficient, but rather because there's something in my spirit. I have a question in my emotions. And we talked about how doubt can be overcome in a variety of ways, but we ended with the reality that the greatest way, or one of the greatest ways, to deal with doubt in our lives is to remember what God has done. When I begin to question something, if I begin to question what God is doing, all I have to do is look back to what God has done in the past, and I can be assured, or I can begin to remove some of that doubt. Now, what I want to do this week is I want to look at the opposite of doubt, or the antithesis of doubt, as it were. And you and I already know that that is faith itself. If doubt is questioning spiritual authority, if doubt is questioning supernatural authority or God's authority, if doubt is a temptation that is known to man, then the opposite of doubt is obviously faith. Or believing in what is unseen, or believing in that which can't possibly be perfectly understood. It's faith, right? And before I begin to discuss faith this morning, what I'd like to suggest to you is that it would be impossible for me to, in one setting, actually clearly articulate all that faith is. Because we could talk about faith as it pertains to God in salvation. We could talk about faith as it pertains to God in healing. We could talk about faith in how it is presented with God and what He is doing around us. There's all different areas of faith, or there's all different ways in which we express our faith. But what I want to do this morning is I want to just paint with a very broad stroke a definition of what faith is supposed to look like in our life and what the purpose of faith is. And in order to do that, I want to look at this story in Mark chapter number 9. The story is set up for us in the first couple of verses. And while we may not relate to this story on a very personal level or with the specifics of the case, you and I, as we get to the bottom of it, will find ourselves, I believe, relating to it in general terms. Watch how it unfolds. In verse number 14, we stumble upon an argument, right, that is going on between the disciples and some scribes who are present there about which position to defend about the measure of faith and healing. In other words, Jesus comes onto the scene, and as he gets there with the crowd, he looks up, and the disciples and the scribes, these religious leaders of the day, are having an argument about what needs to transpire in a specific case, but really about what is the measurement of faith and healing in a person's life. Suddenly, in verse number 15, Jesus appears, and everyone is amazed at his presence, and they want to enlist him into the discussion. Have you ever been there, right? You walk into something, it really had nothing to do with you in the first place, but you walk in and everybody wants to bring you into it. That's where Jesus finds himself. The disciples and the scribes and this crowd is implied here are all having an argument about faith. They're all having an argument about healing. They're all having an argument about what to do with this specific case, but the argument is much broader than that. Jesus shows up and they say, hey, why don't you come over here and solve this for us? And what they were really wanting to know is which side of the debate are you going to take? So in verse number 16, Jesus turns and he asks a question. It's a simple question. He says, what are you arguing about? What is it that you're discussing? What are you trying to solve? And specifically, he asks this question of his disciples. What are you arguing with them about? Well, without hesitation, Father, all of a sudden, who's in the crowd, he makes a proposition or he proposes the problem. Verses 17 and 18, he says, teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down and he foams and he grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out and they were not able. This is the scene that's being set. Jesus walks in on this argument. He turns to his apostles and he says, what are you arguing with the scribes about? And before his disciples can even answer the question, a father pipes up and he says, what they're arguing about is I have brought my son. You can almost hear a little bit of urgency, right? I have brought my son who's seized by an unclean spirit, and the spirit is tormenting him. It causes him to go mute, and it throws him down. It makes him rigid. He foams at the mouth. What are they going to do about it? I want to give a pause here at the moment because I don't know how important it is, but it's worth noting that Jesus asked the crowd, he specifically asked his disciples what they were arguing about, but in the midst of that, it was a father of a child who had the real question to be answered. The reason I think that that's noteworthy is because in his response, we see something, don't we? While the disciples and the scribes were apparently having a theological argument over the matter of what to do with this man's boy, he was having a very, very personal battle. Have you ever felt like that? You have something very, very personal that you're struggling with, something very, very personal that is a battle in your life. And you take it in front of some religious people or you take it to some spiritual people with the hope that they might be able to give you some comfort, give you some peace, be able to work a little bit in your life, give you a little bit of encouragement. But as you come to them, what ends up happening is you get this group of statements or this plethora of philosophical notions that give you absolutely no help at all. That's what this man probably felt like. He brings his son. He's got a personal problem. He's got a very, very personal problem. He brings his son who's dealing with this unclean spirit to be healed. Nobody's able to do it. And in the midst of that, all of a sudden, the scribes and the Pharisees and the disciples, instead of dealing with the personal problem, begin to argue amongst themselves about philosophical and theological principles at which they do not agree. This is so often the case, not only in their world, but within the context of doubt as a whole, and even in our world today. Within the context of a problem, there is those who are dealing with something very personally, and then there are those who are trying to deal with it from a philosophical standpoint. In other words, your brother comes to you and he says to you, I have a toothache, would you pray for me? And you say to him, God is in the toothache. He's going to work all things out for your good. And he says, thank you for that. That really doesn't help me at all. He wants to know what dentist to go to, right? Or he wants you to pray for him, or he wants you to offer some sort of encouragement. But oftentimes, as a community of faith, our response is more philosophical. We want to say, well, just know that I'm here with you, right? James would say it like this in his epistle. He would say that what good is it to the hungry if they come and ask for food and you say, God bless you? What good is it to the homeless if they come and they ask of you and you say, God bless you, but you offer no support, you offer no guidance? Oftentimes in the context of doubt, when somebody in our our circle of friends or our family is struggling with doubt. They come to us or they come to the church, they come to spiritual leaders and they ask for a solution to that problem. They're looking for encouragement. They're looking for some sort of hope. And oftentimes we come back with these philosophical answers that really offer them no hope and encouragement at all. See, when they're suffering, there are those who offer philosophical answers, and there are those who the problem is very, very personal. But to the one in the throat of the problem, the answer to the question was what needed to be very practical. So he pipes up before any of the rest of them can. So often it is with doubt, there is this philosophical that debates or debate that unfolds within the Christian community. I began by stating that they were going to, today we're going to examine faith, which in many ways is the antithesis or the opposite of doubt. But in such a discussion, we find the coldness of a theological position. When a person is doubting, the theologically minded around him oftentimes implore the doubter to simply stop doubting. What happens is somebody comes and they say, I'm struggling with this, I'm doubting, and our response is, just stop doubting. But for the person who is doubting or in that doubting position, the resolution is not that simple. It's not that philosophical. It's not as simple as saying, well, I know God's going to work all things out for the good of those who love him. It is a very personal struggle. They're saying, I wish I could just stop doubting. I wish I could just have faith. I wish I could just begin to believe, but I can't do it. It's not that easy. Because the question of doubt are so personal oftentimes, and oftentimes the person feels like the one trying to answer the questions is not concerned with their position. That's what this father found himself in this moment. Imagine you were him. You have this child who is in an awful condition, and you bring him to the disciples. You have brought him to the scribes. You're asking for their help, and all of a sudden around you, the crowd begins to break out in fight about theological positions of faith. You must be awfully frustrated at this moment. I'm looking for a solution. My son is not well. I want someone to help him. And all of a sudden, the people around you begin to fight about why your son is not well. Some of them probably said, well, you know, it's probably because of sin in his life. Some of them said it's probably because of sin in the father's life. Others said, well, we don't know. Maybe it's not really a spirit at all. Maybe it's a medical condition. And they begin to fight amongst themselves, and the father's sitting there saying, will someone please just help my son? So it is in many ways what we encounter with people today. They come with a problem, most notably a lack of faith. And suddenly the Christian community is thrust into a theological or a philosophical debate over the authorship of faith, the workings of faith, and the effects of faith in a person's life. And all of a sudden, lost in the shuffle is the actual turmoil or the real difficulty that a person is going through. So the father from amidst the crowd, in a desperate plea, when Jesus said, what are you guys arguing about? The father did not give an opportunity for the disciples to respond. He said, I brought my son, and nobody is able to heal him. He said, I'm not going to give these guys a chance to talk. If they talk, they're just going to continue to fight. They're going to continue to argue. They're going to continue to bicker. Here's what the problem is, Jesus. They're over here fighting about these things, and I have a son who is controlled by a spirit who wants to destroy his life. They can't do anything about it. Are you the one who can do something about this? He tells Jesus that he's brought his son with this spirit to the disciples, and he's tasked them to preach the gospel. Jesus had tasked the disciples to preach the gospel, the good news.